kids in and get them off the streets and doing different and working for long term. We're trying our best to, we know that there's problems, and we know that there's this program should be not only for the union workers, it needs to be for the non-union workers. And sometimes for the non-union workers, it's hard for them to get involved in some of the contracts because it's just too hard for the smaller companies. The smaller companies can't have a journeyman carpenter and an apprentice carpenter and a laborer, a journeyman and an apprentice. It's pretty hard to run a company when you're a small company and to carry that kind of a load. So I think it'd be nice that if everyone could put their own agendas to the side, unions, workers, and you guys, and try to put together something where you can sit down across the table and talk and try to work out something between both sides. There's a lot of people that's willing to volunteer their time to make that happen. Thanks. Great.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you all very much. Appreciate it. Thank you. My notes say that we have another panel, Steve Sims, Ray Espana, Tony Jones, is that right? So come on up, please. Good afternoon. You want to start?
Sure, I'll start.
Steve, whoever.
Thank you, Mayor Hales, Council members. Steve Sims, I'm the administrator for the Apprenticeship and Training Division at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We are responsible for the oversight and administration of registered apprenticeship programs in the state. And I'm here simply to talk about a small policy slice of this very rich pie that you've been biting into today. And that's the issue of the impact of mandatory apprenticeship requirements and aspirational diversity goals for women and people of color in public contracting. We've spent a considerable amount of time over the last few years trying to find the root causes for that underrepresentation. We've hired researchers from Portland State Universities. We've hired interns. We've done lots of research on the statistical disparities and also some anecdotal research. And I think that one thing we've concluded is that these requirements have a positive impact on changing those results. In August 2006, women represented about 5.4% of all apprentices registered in the state of Oregon, and ethnic minorities represented 13.5% of all registrations. I use statewide figures, quite frankly, because about 75 to 80% of all apprentices in the state work or live in the Portland metropolitan area. In the 10 years since that time, through August of 2016, the percentage of women has increased to 6.3% of all registrations, and the percentage of protected class minorities have increased to 18.1%. So there is decent progress with respect to increase in the minority participation, but the nagging issue is how do we bring up the participation of women in registered apprenticeship programs in the state. The active registration figures do not even address a more daunting challenge, and this is why the mandatory apprenticeship requirements are important. We did a study where we took a four-year period, 2006 to 2010, and to give us a full cohort, the average apprenticeship program lasts 4 years. We wanted to see what happened with completion rates over the course of 4 years. In focusing on that four-year period, between 2006 and 2010, only 21.5% of all African-American apprentices who entered an apprenticeship program completed, and only 38% of all women who entered an apprenticeship program completed and become journey workers. In other words, we lost almost 80% of the African-American apprentices who made that investment and 62% of the female apprentices who started during that four-year period. In contrast, during the same period, the average completion rate for Caucasian male apprentices was 54.5%. African-American apprentices are much more likely to exit their programs during their first 6 months of their apprenticeship. 23% of them during that study period exited during the first 6 months, and 32% of all women, while only 12% of the white males who entered their programs exited. We can get people in. We are having a problem getting women and people of color to complete their programs. To update those figures for fiscal year 2015, the numbers are amazingly similar. 52% of all white males completed their programs, while women completed at a 30% rate, all protected class minority groups had a 44% completion rate. Our study has determined that there are three basic reasons as to why there's such a high loss rate for women and minority apprentices, but I really want to focus on one that directly goes back to the mandatory apprenticeship utilization requirement. We know statistically that women and people of color face longer periods of unemployment between their apprenticeship assignments than white males. There are a variety of reasons for that. They don't have the same informal network to stay employed. But the bottom line is, for minority and female apprentices, working a full-time minimum wage job is preferable to the wage and job instability of participating in an apprenticeship program and not knowing when you will work again, so they leave. Public contracting requirements that mandate the use of registered apprenticeship and establish workforce diversity goals can help get more underrepresented workers through their apprenticeship program. It generates demand for those workers. And as you could see from the numbers that were discussed earlier, particularly with respect to Interstate and Kelly Butte, it works. When you tell contractors, this is what we want to see, they perform. The city should be applauded for its efforts dating back to 1996 when the workforce training and hiring program was first implemented. We know that mandatory apprenticeship requirements with aspirational utilization goals for women and people of color result in greater opportunity. Number one, there is a demand for new apprentices, and that's where you're going to get more female and minority apprentices, by bringing them in new. And it also creates a greater demand for them to continue to work. The two CBA projects that were discussed today, Kelly Butte and Interstate, both produced female and minority participation rates that are substantially higher than our overall participation rates for women and people of color in this state. It has a dramatic difference when you're talking about the difference between 6.3% female participation and 18%, I believe, on Interstate. I think on the two projects collectively, the average was about 46% minority participation, and we have a statewide average of 18%. These projects drive the numbers to create more opportunity for women and people of color. The causal relationship, if a public owner, and I think these type of strategies should apply to all public owners, if a public owner that encourages vendors to hire a diverse workforce, more responsible contractors and their affiliated apprenticeship programs will deliver. And that's not a union issue or a non-union issue. It's a performance issue. The other thing I wanted to briefly speak about is the issue of pre-apprenticeship programs. And I heard a couple of things regarding pre-apprenticeship programs. I want to talk briefly to some of the other strategies we engage in. We have a contractual relationship with ODOT where we have about $2 million per biennium to provide supportive services, recruitment, and outreach targeted for women, people of color, and disadvantaged communities. When I buy a spot in a pre-apprenticeship program with our ODOT dollars, I'm happy when I see that person who might have come in and their first job was a highway job, but then I find out they're working a City of Portland job. I'm happy that. Another thing we do with our supportive services dollars is we buy tools, equipment, we help with childcare. I know when I get a request from an apprentice who says, I need help with childcare so I can go to work, and I say, well, you want ODOT dollars to do that. What job are you working? I'm working a City of Portland job on vertical construction. I don't have a problem with that. They're working in the trades. They're working in a carpenter or a laborer or an operator. And they can be building a building for the City of Portland one day, and 6 months later they can be on a highway job. We need a unified approach, leveraging as much funding as we can to support pre-apprenticeship, and I truly believe the 1% set aside is one way to build on that continued support for pre-apprenticeship. In closing, some progress has been made in addressing the historic underutilization of women and people of color in the trades. Utilization requirements, aspirational goals, pre-apprenticeship programs, and technical assistance to contractors, as the prior panelists spoke about, have been essential parts of this progress, and the city should continue with its leadership in these areas. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sir, I'm sorry that nature called and I wasn't here when you began your presentation, but I just want to put a marker down. The comment you made about a unified approach, so we don't have a series of one-offs, but that there is a progression and we can knit together contracting opportunities, I believe is the next big thing we need to look at, and not just locally but regionally, and not just obviously city projects but state projects and metro and others. And I think if we can work collaboratively towards that idea that you start here but you continue to go, and it's not just, you know, your job ends here and you're unemployed and you have another thing. And by the way, I think, Ray, the big opportunity we're going to have in this area comes with Superfund, because we have a 10-year horizon. And we can start looking at long-term job training, long-term skill development. But that idea, and I think it's been alluded to by OMF and by procurement, of knitting this system together with our partners, I think is a big idea that's come out of this discussion. And I think we have to take a good hard look at it. So thank you.
Mr. Sims, thank you very much. You just gave us another independent assessment of how this has all worked. And I suspect that where we're going to end up at the end of today or in the future is a work session to look at what way forward. There has been lots of different advice. I hope that Labor Commissioner Bradavakian will allow you, and if you'll be willing to come back for that to help craft whatever the next iteration of this process is. So thank you very much.
Certainly.
And did you submit your testimony in writing?
I did not.
If you would, please, that would be lovely.
Most helpful if you would. Thank you.
Mr. Espana.
Yes, thank you. Ray Espana with NAIA, Native Americans and Family Center. It's a blessing to be with you today, as it is always. I
am going to try to be succinct and hopefully on point. And I'm asking you to listen to my words with your heart, with your mind, with your spirit, as you kind of try to manage a lot of information, a lot of passion and stuff as we come to know it. And I was thinking about what I would be saying to you today, addressing friends. And I thought about Commissioner Novick, and I participated in a panel at PCC, and I think it was sponsored by Labor at the time, but it's 2007 as things begin to crash and unemployed people and what are we going to do and stuff. And so I participated, got to meet this young man, and the messages that I was hearing, the stories, the concerns, the fear, all that stuff of being unemployed, or how do we get to this next thing, is things I hear, union, non-union, it's reality, you know? And so that began the work for me to work to contribute to a coalition of labor and community to address a common goal of putting people to work and creating the housing and being healthy and watching our children grow up. And I think with there is no disagreement about that, right? And so let me begin to say that I want to again express my gratitude for City Council to, in 2012, for passing the original ordinance. I heard about the passing of the ordinance while I was in a hospital bed in Seattle, recovering from a health issue, and I'll just leave it at that. But I couldn't have been more proud of the folks that presented the idea, had worked for years on that idea, that I hope that was responsive to enlightened, excited leadership of the opportunity, right? And so to that end, I just have complete gratitude for the leadership that created that opportunity, and I'm here to help celebrate what I think have been phenomenal results and the performance of that effort. You've heard about the LMCOC, I'm not sure the...
That's right.
Yeah, but friends who have spent time to make it work. And I think, you know, I just want to recognize and I respect the effort by all those that participated in achieving significant results. And I think it did one thing. And we're going to be talking about it. You're going to be talking about it in the community, I believe, created and fosters the idea of hope for people. A path, a way, a connection, an opportunity by any door, right? Whether it be on MLK in Ainsworth to wherever you go, there's a way to get to what you need. But, however, I'm also kind of very confused and disappointed, frankly, with what I identify, and this is me personally as I look at you, as I identify as the cities, and I use that blankly, the city, right, not personal, as the city's lack of true equity understanding and awareness. I think there is a missing piece or something. I'm not sure. I'm totally frustrated about this. I believe that equity has a clarity of purpose, that it's a focused, intentional series of actions. It's built on guiding principles, simple principles that I would hope we agree on principles of inclusion, recognition and appreciation of community, all the stakeholders that fill this room, the community partnerships and coalitions that have come and formed. That's who's out here supporting or having their eyes on and fill this room who are going to give you a slice of the truth. We all tell our truth in some ways. But equally important, I think, with equity is now the challenge before any advocates on equity, and that is the accountability for achieving not aspirational goals, but achieving real results. I'm pleased the commissioner talks about, you know, the buck stops with him, and he's on your behalf that you're taking and rising the expectations, and I think that needs to get translated and maybe translated into part of the training of city staff to understand completely what that means. Because I think there's an information and learning or competency gap, because the concern I hear in other tables is the lack of progress on closing gaps of equity or inequities. The coalition, the work that we do, has been very clear on the social economic disparities in our community. Very clear. The data case has been made of public policy failure in this regard. And so we need to move forward with looking at the inclusions, and any attempt to frame moving forward without community, I believe, is doomed from the start, right? So there must be clarity of message to me, and you can only speak to me, Nick, Commissioner Fish, that when you say that you're raising the expectations and you can be personally or administratively, you're the leader in some regard, I believe your truth. And I hold you personally responsible, knowing that you may not be at any of the meetings that will happen somewhere else. So somehow your personal commitment and your belief has got to be translated. And I think it's a challenge by any of you who want a more socially just community to translate good intentions and policy into practice. So when you continually see reports that show the historic inequities on contracting, on participation of minority contractors, when have you asked why? When was the last time you asked why? We keep on seeing results saying somehow we keep on getting the same old shitty results, right? And we don't get it. It's got to be beyond us. No. The CBA effort proved that performance, if outlined, can be achieved, can be met, and that is the owners of projects need to be clear and set those expectations. That, those, I hate the military reference, those marching orders to staff, to implement those practices, to change. The resistance to change is embedded in the city hall structure or in your other building. The equity and reform is a reform agenda. It's a change agenda. And how long do you intend to wait? Don't ask me to wait, right? And that's part of the message that I have a little bit of trouble with today. And I'm sorry, Tony. Let me just kind of wrap this thing up here. So I'm not completely sure what actions, if any, you're going to be taking today. I would hope that you hear the truth that many need to speak. I looked at what I would call a staff report to frame this kind of session, and I found the staff report deficient in giving you clear direction that was completely quite thought through. And I don't want to throw the rider under the bus. I'm just saying I looked at something that was utilized to kind of suggest let's move forward. And what was missing clearly there for me was the role of stakeholders and community, not recognizing and integrating a sense of accountability. And I think the last thing I think you would ask me is that I guess I recognize the lack of good faith, goodwill in this matter. And that really concerns me. If we're not being invited to meetings or agendas being this, that's just. And so I think it would be a tragedy to move forward if it remains unclear and unsupported as you consider your next actions. And let me just close by saying that I'm not going to talk about other points to try to reinforce my point. I'm just saying that I think I understand what the challenge is on your behalf. I don't sit on that side of the table. I think the challenge is clear, and clearly the decision is yours.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Tony?
Good afternoon, Mayor Hill, City Council. My name is Tony Jones. I'm the Executive Director of Metropolitan Contractor Improvement Partnership. Real quickly, we're a business center for contractors. We have a plan center. We provide monthly workshops, and we do one-on-one coaching and counseling. We were founded by NAMAC in Oregon in 2008, and I've been the executive director since. I reviewed the reports and the surrounding supporting documentation, evaluating the CBA services on Kelly Butte and Interstate, and I want to discuss the following. I want to discuss some recommendations to revisions to the model, why I believe a broader model is needed. I also want to talk about technical assistance, because that's what I do every day, and technical assistance costs. I want to talk a little bit about union investment and improved practices in relationships with unions, and then just close quickly with a couple recommendations. I believe that a broader model is needed, and I'm going to reiterate for a second just to remind you of where the city is with regard to contracting with minorities and women. As you know, from the 2014 data, the city awarded $76.3 million in prime contracts. 95% of those dollars went to white male contractors. Only 5% of all prime contracts were awarded to minority women firms. So despite, the successes and even some of the challenges with the CBA or other CMGC projects, overall the city's track record, you got a long way to go. So you have to have a broader model. Models where you're doing one-offs or one project here or there is not going to get you to the goal that you need to accomplish. City lags on its goals, and also think that you need a two-pronged strategy for capacity building. Project-based assistance, and you also need assistance in building the pipeline. And I do want to kind of respond to some comments in the report about technical assistance and technical assistance costs. One of the things I want to point out as a technical assistance provider is that when we work with minority contractors, when folks come through our door, they don't automatically say, I want to work on a city project. They don't know where our funds come from. They don't know what restrictions we have on our funds. What they do know is that I need help with my business. How do I write a business plan? I have a problem with a change order. I'm not getting paid. How do I get started? How do I solve these certain business issues do I have? I want to partner with another contractor to do work. How do I do that? They don't necessarily know where we get our money from, but they know that they want this type of assistance on their project. We view our role at MCIP as an organization that is really trying to build that pipeline of contractors that are going to be working on city projects and other projects and really helping that owner meet the vision. If they really want to do residential projects, I support their vision because that's their vision. It's their company. It's what they're passionate about and what they want to do. So I really support the city really evaluating it as it provides technical assistance. Is project-based technical assistance is absolutely needed, you know, as you're working on specific projects to make sure you accomplish your goals. But to get there, we have to continue to develop a pool of contractors that's available. And the same thing happened on the workforce side. So when I read the report and it had comments about, well, so many dollars went to contractors that didn't work on the project, my feedback is the challenge is that's part of the real world of contracting. Only so many of those contractors are going to get on a project, but some of them may want to have continued interest in working with the city and want to know, how do I get there? I think,
Tony, without going into any depth on that, I'm going to say this as discreetly as I can. The one challenge, and I just want us to keep this in mind, is that these were both pilot projects funded with ratepayer dollars.
We don't have to debate
that point. I'm just saying that we have a particular burden of showing that when we use ratepayer dollars, the benefits accrue to the project. We have more latitude with general fund dollars. One of the things that I've been thinking about is, apropos of your point, is substituting out general fund dollars for other dollars, color of money. But I'm just saying, we are a little more limited in what we can do with ratepayer dollars, and we can't quite be as broad in our application.
Well, I'm looking at a broader strategy, Commissioner Fish, because I'm looking at the overall goal and helping us, at least sharing my ideas of in concert with others and of how collectively we can accomplish the goal. So overall, bottom line, it's not about the percentages, but putting the businesses to work, putting the workers to work. And that's when folks come in our office, like I said, that's not in the back of their mind about ratepayer dollars. I hear you.
No, but and I know since we're friends, yeah, you don't want me getting sued. I'm just saying that
yeah,
it's just a detail.
Yeah, understood.
I'm just asking you to keep color of money.
No, I. So I'm just saying we should try to find other ways and be creative. Real quickly, I do want to comment on, because I was slightly concerned, even though we had a small contract in the project, we were held accountable, even though we had like a $5,000 contract in that project. We were held accountable. There were goals set on what we were supposed to do as a service provider to help that small business move along. We had one small business we did not move along with because it didn't work out. We had one small business that it did. And there was accountability held to us in providing the technical assistance. And I really think that that's really an important message, because there's always a concern about, like you said, are we making an impactful investment? And I do have a concern about how we look at and address programs that serve communities of color. If you have an overall project that was under budget, I'm not saying you should never look at the efficiencies, but if the overall project is under budget, to me, there's an overall success. I'm not saying you never look for improvement, but sometimes I get concerned as a leader of color of how we look at investments in communities of color to help them grow when they have had this disadvantage for numbers of years. I'm not saying just give out money, but I'm just saying we should just consider that and look carefully of how we're making investments and recognize we do have to invest to help grow and get to the scale so we can continue to work on your opportunities. One of the things I want to talk about is more, and this is more broader, not necessarily specifically on the project, but sort of investment by signatory trades. In this particular endeavor, I know that they put a lot of volunteer time on the table. I know that they also invest a lot of dollars, probably through their own respective programs, to help get their apprentices into the program, trained up and what have you. But we all know that they do have resources. They are fairly strong organizations. And talking about creativity, are there ways that we can partner with these organizations to bring more dollars to help build the capacity of not only the contractors, but as well as the workforce, where we could have maybe some unrestricted dollars to be creative and do some things that we've been trying to do to help get more minority workers and more minority contractors participating. The other comment I do want to share, which is one of my biggest concerns, is also that small non-signatory contractors do a number of times struggle in working with signatory trades and becoming signatory. And there was a challenge on the project with a contractor that did become signatory, but he has felt, and this is his own words, sharing with me in office, is that, you know, after that, he feels like he's continued to get pressure from the signatory trades to continue to be signatory, even though he, you know, wasn't sure he wanted to continue. So I think we need to just improve how we engage with those businesses, because we do want to have businesses feel like that they can partner with signatory trades and go forward. Some of the recommendations I make is that I do think that we really need to ratchet up this type of effort. We do need to ratchet up a model that, frankly, not just looks at one project, but a series of projects, and how can we use that series of projects to get to accomplish some of the goals that we want to set overall, not just on individual projects. And it does include all the stakeholders that I think we've involved, and it needs to continue. But I do think it needs to be a broader, larger effort. And I do think that we need to consider whether firms need to have any type of signature, be signatory to an agreement at all that's connected to the trades. I have no problem with the trades actively participating, but some of the small businesses we work with were very concerned about, that's what frightened them, is that, oh, you know, I'm signing with the union, whether it's true or not. So can we consider a way that the partnership, that we can really coach firms versus them signing onto an agreement? But I also think that there's a quick list of things. We need to develop the contracting and workforce goals based on the projects that we think might best fit minority women workers and contractors. We also need to develop an implementation strategy that continues, you know, goals, monitoring, and accountability. We need to set aside the financial resources to increase the pool of contractors and workers. And like I said earlier, we need to have dollars that work with firms specifically on projects and ways that we can continue to build the pool. And we want to continue to partner with the unions to collaborate so that we can market their services and how they can benefit contractors and workers, and where small contractors don't feel like sometimes they're being penalized for being in some type of relationship with the trades.
Well, Tony, my one takeaway from your testimony is that this is going to take a number of work sessions that I will set up with Mr. Fritz, because while there's a number of things that have been said today that I fundamentally disagree with, the positive feature of this forum is that people are pitching really good ideas and also getting to what we all care about, which is results. And in my job, I sometimes think we end up arguing over the wrong things. Maybe that's what my wife says to me sometimes. That's why it echoes in my head. But I don't think we disagree about goals, and I have heard some spectacular suggestions today on things. And one thing I didn't hear from you, but that I hear consistently from folks that you work with, is access to capital and bonding. And I think the challenge of government is not to look at these things in just little boxes, is, as you said, sir, to look holistically. And that might be the gift this forum is giving us, is to look more broadly at how we get to those goals and figure out what the array of tools we need to help people be successful. So I appreciate your testimony. Thank you. Now, Mayor,
thank you very much.
We are halfway through this forum. We're going to let people, if they have to take a bathroom break, but no. We're now going to move to the public comment phase. And then, Don, thank you, sir. Our distinguished director of equity is going to stick around and give us a closing statement.
Well, yeah, let me actually do a process check here, because I think we're actually going to have a quorum problem. So,
Carla, how many people signed up?
Like 44.
So they may not all still be here.
Raise your hand if you still want to testify.
People that still want to speak? All right, we might manage it. We're going to lose one of our members at 5 and another at 5:30. So another option, in addition to trying to hear as many people while we still have a quorum as possible, is to save further discussion with staff, including our Office of Equity and Human Rights Director and maybe others, until we continue the hearing, because we might need to do that. And I've got a time available on the 28th if we want to.
I will second that, Mayor. And I also think it's important that we restate that there is no substantive action we're taking on any changes to policy or whatever. This is a forum with decisions to be made about how we begin to process this information.
Right.
But to the concern that some people have had that we're on the precipice of doing something, that's not true. So
right.
Why don't
let's
excuse Dante and just go to public testimony?
All right. Dante is free to stay and listen, but I think we'll save your analysis until we continue, because I have a date and time of the 28th at time certain at 2:45 p.m.
Dante, how long was your presentation? Okay. Well, let's see, Mayor. Maybe if everyone stayed within 2 minutes.
All right,
let's
see if we can be brief and maybe give Dante a chance at bat while we're still here.
Well, I actually have several questions for other staff as well.
Okay. All right. Well, let's proceed into testimony and see how we do. But we are going to lose a quorum.
By the way, for those of you who are here to show solidarity with one point of view, I just restate that we'd rather hear it clearly stated once than repeated 20 times. And if there are 19 people that agree with you and there are people willing to give up their slot, you could just acknowledge that there's other people sharing that view. But the sheer weight of the same testimony doesn't make as much of impression as the quality of one testimony.
Okay. Onward.
The first three are Maggie Talmadge, Hayes Witt, and Bev Logan. And they'll be followed by Ngunge Harmon Johnson, Iris Gandila.
If you're hearing
Isis
your name,
Harris.
Ngunge, come on up. I think some of those other folks aren't still
here. If you're
here,
upstairs,
so.
An entrance.
You're on the list,
walk in,
you
get
come
called.
Down. I think a lot of people have left, so come on down if you have signed up there.
All right, let's take these two community leaders.
James, come up. Let's just
James,
say, we don't want to.
Appreciate it.
Right. Maggie, go ahead.
Thank you, Commission. Mayor Hales. First, I'd like to offer my support to the many others, John Gardner, Casey Bernard, Kelly Haynes in the audience, Maurice Roming, Ray Espana, who have offered testimony against the watered-down program that and document that the city has in front of it. There's a better way. The CBA pilot Water Bureau projects delivered dramatically historic results, illustrating the potential positive outcomes when this tool is applied to large capital projects. Second, I'd like to direct my testimony not only to this council, but to the city staff working on this project. I want to ask you to take the time to see things through my eyes, through the eyes of the members of the Coalition of Communities of Color, and many of Portland's people of color. When I walk through the central city on my way to the CCC's office in Old Town, I pass by many of our downtown restaurants, and when I look into the windows, I almost always see a sea of white faces. Portland's people of color, we're not there. We're a third of the population, but we're not there. If I start to make my way across the river and I walk by the many new buildings that are changing our city's skyline and image, and I look at the signs on the construction fences, I see the names of construction companies, general contractors, subcontractors, suppliers, and I see the names of professional services firms, architects, engineers, designers, businesses that are building multi-generational wealth and reputations in our construction boom. Portland's people of color, we're not there. And often, my work takes me to the many institutions that lead our city, our philanthropies, our financial institutions, our health systems, our development sector, our universities, our governments. I see CEOs, bureau directors, decision makers. We're not there. So staff and council, when you hear testimony today about the shortcomings of the program, when you listen closely to our guidance about why and how the program needs to be changed, what we're really telling you is that we've looked at the program closely, and we're not there. So the main issues with the document proposed include, and I'll defer to a lot of the experts in the room too.
Excuse me, could I just suggest that you send it in writing since we're not going to be taking action today? And are you representing somebody at this?
I am representing the Coalition of Communities of Color.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Maggie, if there's a watered-down version of something that you're testifying about, could you also include that in your testimony?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Posey.
Yes. good afternoon or good evening. I think it's late now. My name is James Posey, Mr. Mayor, and other city commissioners. Listen, I just want to give a little different take here because, you know, I've been around this for quite a while myself. And we have an example of success, and that's TriMet. I wish I could give you, I mean, you're looking for ideas. Why reinvent the wheel? No CBA. They're touted across the nation. They have a national reputation. Why are we going hither and there, et cetera? Let me just tell you what Fred Hansen said to, I think, his staff. I wasn't there, but I heard. Hey, you guys, I'm paying you good money to get this job done, both brick and mortar and diversity. Come back to me with solutions. I want it done. No excuses. No tolerance. Now, what really underlines this whole thing, and you know it, all of you sitting on this board, the elephant in the room is racism and discrimination. That's the truth. And unless we speak that and get it out into the atmosphere, we're not going to solve this problem. I don't care how long or whatever we talk about. It's racism and discrimination. No tolerance. We're looking in North Carolina where you got riots. You know, I'm around long enough to know the racism and the stuff that happened in Watts and all that. You know, I'm that old. And really, it was about the Warner, the reports that were back then, the absence of opportunity and communities of color. I suggest to you, Mr. Mayor, and you, Mr. Commissioner, since you know the leadership responsibility on this thing, you could say no tolerance for racism and discrimination. When the unions come to the table and tell you all these stories and this and that, where is your diversity? You want to work for the city of Portland. You want to use taxpayers' dollars. Where is your diversity? Let's see how many journey people you have in your crafts and your organization. Let's see what you can do about making diversity work. The onus of control and responsibility should be placed on those who are seeking an opportunity with the city, trying to take my taxpayers' dollars. And that also applies to the contractor, both minority and general. You know, when I read in the paper about Hoffman taking that $500,000 and what's his name? I forget his name. Break said something about, well, we should get that dollar. It's hard work. Well, I don't want to start cussing here, but at the end of the day, they got big money. It was their responsibility to have diversity in their program, and we're paying them to do that. And I listened to John Gardner, consummate bureaucrat, Mr. Sims. They've been around for years. These guys are over here wringing their hands about a community benefits program that really is the onus responsibility for assuring that we have diversity should rest with those coming to the table. That's why I could never understand why you would approve a CBA without first asking those unions, what have you done? Why would you allow a CBA? Your workforce for the last 40 years have been absence of anybody of color. If we're talking about the diversity, look at the onus of control. Look at where the money is. Why don't you make the unions put together all the money for all these outreach programs? And I want to put Tony out of business. No offense, Tony. I want to put her out of business. We will know when we're making success when this young lady here, who I saw back in the day, is no longer in business, because there will be enough responsibility shifted to the people who get the benefit to make this thing happen. That's really what I want to say to you all today. There are a lot of other things. The regional idea is good.
In fairness, we're running out of time. Too. Yeah. Could you put the rest in writing?
Yeah, I will. Thank you. I want to commend you on the regional idea. Ask Ron Wyden, ask the guy at TriMed. The whole concept of a regional approach to this thing needs to occur. yesterday.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We have the distinguished executive director of the Urban League.
You're on, Nkenge. Thank you.
Hi there. Mr. Mayor, commissioners, I will be brief, and I would ask you to perhaps cast your gaze past the subject, the immediate subject at hand. I am here to both support what some of my counterparts have said from Constructing Hope and other organizations, including coalitions of communities of color, because there are partners in this work. But I want you to look past sort of the immediate report and some of the details that you've heard today and think about your jobs more broadly. You ask us as community-based organizations to come to the table to work together with other organizations, with citizens in the community, and with city bureaus all the time. You see me here regularly and in other places doing this work because it's what you tell us is the way to reach the goals that we want to achieve because you as electeds cannot do it by yourself. And we, those groups who are not-for-profit organizations, come together and say, all right, we'll do it. We're signing up to do the work. And many times, folks and organizations like the Urban League, for example, who don't directly have a dog in this fight are at the tables. My way, we're there. One of the first meetings I had when I took over as president of the Urban League 18 months ago was related to the CBA so that I could start to learn how this works and what the details are and who the bodies and the folks are. All right, we're here. We're partners. We're ready to learn and to work together because you ask us to reach the goals that we have together. Now we're here before you today telling you that we've done the work and done the process and done our part, but the report that's in front of you doesn't meet the standard that we've set for ourselves together. So look past that for a moment and think about all the work you do related to getting kids summer jobs, all the talk that's happened in this chamber and elsewhere with your constituents related to housing stability and folks being able to afford to keep a roof over their homes. Look past a little bit further and think about what we're trying to do with graduation rates in this town, the way we're trying to improve health equity for everyone. Now come back and think about what we've all been talking about today. All of those things are very much connected, and you can't think about them separately. So when we're telling you that this doesn't meet the muster, it's not just in the silo of the immediate data. It's considering the fact that black folks in this town and black men in North and Northeast Portland still have unemployment levels in the double digits. That's not true of anyone else. It's directly connected to some of the failures by folks who are making big bucks, building big projects in this town and aren't hiring the people who have lived in those communities for a very long time. And you have the opportunity and the responsibility to do something about it. The folks who work hands on the ground every day, my organization and others, are telling you that what's in front of you doesn't get us there. So my request is to you that you consider our words and think again about what's been presented to you by city staff and others, and know that we come to you in good faith, prepared to continue working with you, but you got to reach back towards us. You got to let us know that when we put in this work for years and years and months, and we do it for free or for, you know, on the cheap, that we've got to know that you're similarly investing and will believe us when we tell you what we have found in the end. That's my request to council today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Could you just put your name in the record, please? Put your name in the record.
I will. Thank you for doing that for me, Mr. Mayor. But I am Nkenge Harmon Johnson, President and CEO of the Urban League of Portland.
Ma'am, you're on.
I'm not sure if I follow the proper protocol. I heard you call my name. I'm Isis Harris. I'm currently an apprentice with the IBEW and a former graduate of the Constructing Hope program. And today I came here to talk about the merits of the Constructing Hope program, what it's done for me, but also to speak on some of the struggles that people may face in going through apprenticeship and getting into, or excuse me, even finding the road to pre-apprenticeship to get into apprenticeship. I went to prison in 2005. I was released in 2011. When I was released from prison, I went to school, but in trying to find employment, I faced several different obstacles. Shortly after getting out of prison, one of my children was incarcerated. Shortly before finding Constructing Hope, one of my children was shot in the face. There were different things that I had to deal with as far as just staying on my path, as far as staying focused on what I wanted to do, but Constructing Hope was instrumental in helping me to not only chiseled down my goals and to find out what it was that I needed to do in order to strengthen myself from within, in order to make sure that everything that I was doing around me reflected what I actually wanted in my life, but they gave me a feeling of confidence. They gave me the tools that I needed to go into the workforce. They helped me to create a vision for my life that helped me to establish goals that were realistic. And as I continued on my path and I started to achieve those goals, I was able to basically position myself with the IBEW in an apprenticeship. I started off as a material handler. I've been in the apprenticeship for a year now, and I can attest to some of the challenges on the work site as well, as going to a work site and seeing no one who looks like you. I'm currently on a work site. I'm the only Black woman, and there's two women on the site. So it is challenging at times to feel inclusive or to feel included in different situations because the parallels are so different. I have people that I work with who are journeymen who are the same age as my oldest son. So there's these different chasms that you have to kind of jump in order to continue to push yourself forward and to know that, okay, I have all these obstacles that I've made it past, but just getting into apprenticeship, it doesn't solve everything. But it does give you the pathway in order to make your life better. And again, the foundation for me being where I am today is Constructing Hope, because even as I went through pre-apprenticeship and I had to worry about housing, I had to worry about transportation, and they helped me with some of those issues. The administrative assistant linked me in with her husband, who got me a part-time job while I was going there. And those are the things that they do. They go above and beyond to ensure that you can be successful in the goals that you set forth. And getting into the apprenticeship, again, it wasn't an immediate fix, but it did help me to see forward. It helped me to have a vision on what my life would look like, because you can pretty much measure it out. As long as you continue to work throughout your apprenticeship, you can measure out what your financial goals will be, what your stability will look like, or what type of things you can attain for your family to have that feeling of security. And Constructing Hope has always been there for me, regardless of whatever I'm going through. I can always call Pat Daniels, and I can tell her what I'm going through, and she'll direct me to the right resources, anything that I may need in order to get to that next step. And I'm proud today to say that I'm a proud IBEW member, and also recently elected to Vice President of the Electrical Workers Minority Caucus. It has been... Thank you. I do believe that... the integrity that has been instilled in me, not only from Constructing Hope, but also being a member of the IBEW, has helped me to basically see inside of myself as far as what power I do have, what personal power I do have, but also it has encouraged me to reach out. I went back into the prison in August and spoke to the women there about the opportunities they have as long as they stay focused on what they really want out of life and trying to avoid the pitfalls in life, to let them know that there's opportunities out there for them to get into the workforce, to get into the trades, and be self-sufficient. I've also contacted the alternative school that I went to. I'm going back to speak to the students there to let them know also that it doesn't matter about what you've been through. It's about what you want to make out of your life. It's about how you want to apply your own personal power to make sure that your goals get attained. I've been lucky I've been lucky because I have mentors, but those are mentors that I reached out for within the IBEW, Constructing Hope, or in the community.
Harris, thank you so much for staying as late as you have to give us, because you've just completely outlined why this program is so important and why people, it needs to be available for you and for the people that you're now mentoring. So thank you so much for staying.
No problem.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you all. Keep up your leadership, please, Ms. Harris. Thank you.
Melina Weisner, Michael A. Birch, Nate Stokes, Vicky Guevara. Oh, Iris. Sorry, Gandania. Thank you. Gandaria. Iris, thank you.
Come on.
See who's here. Those people I've called. Come on up. Charles Potter. Oh,
All right, let's take these three, and then we'll see where we are.
Keep Billy, going. Are you on the list?
Okay.
Why don't you come up?
Come on up. Take the fourth seat and let
them. We know what kind of day you've had.
Go ahead.
We know what kind of evening you have scheduled, so. Yeah.
All right.
Ma'am, why don't you go first?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for allowing me to give you my testimony. Also, I first want to really say thank you. I'm really happy to hear that there's so many organizations in this room that have my back.
Name as you start, please.
Okay. My name is Iris Gandaria, and I'm a fifth-term welder steam fitter apprentice with Local 290, and I really love my career, and I really love my union. They pay me a really good living wage with benefits, vacation pay, and retirement. More importantly, when I'm done with this, I'll get to be a highly trained and skilled union hand, which I'm very proud of. Being a woman of color in the trades is complicated, and being in the trades is very competitive. Getting into a union is the first step, but staying in is even harder to get the training I need to be successful. This is critical to my success. Most of my learning as an apprentice is done on the job with tools in my hand. And I can testify that PLAs are game changers for women and minorities to stay employed in the construction trades. I want to add that without the help of organizations like Oregon Tradeswomen, which I'm a graduate of 2005, and PYB in 2002, I wouldn't be where I am today. Fast forward to 2014, I was lucky enough to land a really good job, best job, because of the Powell Butte Water Reservoir Project. I landed on a very unique job site. What made it so special and such a great experience, well, was that it was really nice to see so many women on the job, belling the crane, building scaffolding, building forms, laying in big bore pipe. It was really impressive. I can say that I had a hand in building that Kelly Butte Water Reservoir project. As a result, this is probably the best part for me, I had the opportunity to show my dedication of being a hard worker and my willingness to learn. I want to emphasize on how critical this one chance, this one opportunity, really, really helped catapult my career. The contractor kept me on, and I was able to work with really talented people that taught me a lot about my craft, and I'm really grateful for that. I don't think I would have had that opportunity had it not been for this project labor agreement, because I have to break, you know, so many perceptions and stereotypes. I don't often get picked, but this time I did, and they liked me, and I liked them. So
that's great.
Thank you so much for staying.
Thank you.
Really appreciate
it. Thank you very much. Welcome.
I'm Nate Stokes with the Operating Engineers 701. I want to speak on the community or the CBA. I was a project manager for a woman-owned business at the time of the interstate renovation project. I saw the benefits on a subcontracting side and what we were held to, the standards of getting the minority contractor and apprenticeships in there and everything. So I want to say that it works. I witnessed it as a subcontractor for a woman-owned business. And I'm speaking on behalf of the operating engineers. I urge you not to accept the report written, but instead we advocate for the CBA that was used in the pilot programs. So mine was short and sweet.
Thank you very much. Mr. Birch.
Mayor, commissioners that are left, thank you for having us today. Excuse me. Been sitting back there for a while. We began this particular effort over 6 years ago by inviting everyone in the community to help work on a plan to expand the diversity of the construction industry and workforce in the city we all live in. Some of those invited accepted the opportunity to work on an inclusive plan and overcame historical divisions to do so. As mentioned earlier, there wasn't a lot of trust in the room when we first sat down. Others that were invited refused and attempted to derail the effort by attempting to make the work of the CBA and us against them, union versus non-union debate, and tore at the seams of the process that we had painstakingly put together. Much to my dismay, many of those same divisive people continue that line of argument today in spite of the historic progress.